we met the airport, we shook hands, and all he said is, "Honey, the plane." He said, "It's a plane, Mr. Wilson, either Mr. or whatever it was. We have them." I shook him. I said, "Go ahead." The Mirage, from the French. We have the Mirage. He was getting them then. They came to our room. When would that have been? 56?
That was third the war in 56. I mean, it was...
50.
The Mirage was after Sinai, between Sinai and 67. I can't remember the date now. However, so in general, but personally, you probably thought that you couldn't live in a kibbutz life.
I never occurred to me that I could even try. The man with any pro-kibbutz was that foolish fellow, Edwin Saville, who loved kibbutzim, very English way. No, I could live in a kibbutz for 6 months, but I couldn't settle there, no. Nor could I anywhere. In Palestine anyway. I asked myself that question, naturally. I realized that I was too far gone. That I was too far gone in my career, in my ideas. There would be nobody left me to talk to. I would admire them. I felt exactly like a Russian socialist for the Russian villages of 1880. I would prepare to do anything for them. But I didn't know. I'd get up in the morning. I wasn't idealistic enough. I don't think I wanted to live a simple life. I think I was an intellectual. And in Palestine at that time, there wasn't much room for it, not then, whatever. You see, for a kind of adequate intellectual life. Maybe there is now, much more than before.
There was probably more 10 years ago.
Well, I mean, all right.
Yes.
I mean,
those are of course two different questions. I mean, being able to live in Israel in the 30s or the 40s, or let's say the 60s or the 70s.
But as you know, I was offered a job for Sharet over the telephone in 1940. I told you the story. I was sitting in my room in your college, talking to David Sissel. Telephone rang, and he says, "Moshe Sharet, we have a post for you. Would you like to be the head of the East European department of the agency? The head of it is Walter Eitan." But anyhow, wouldn't have suited me. But I said, no, Fred, I can't do that. 47. Summer 47.
It was not divided into 40. So it's not insured.
I can't help you, yes. Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, yes. Poland, whatever there was. So, summer 47.
Sure.
After I came back, was it after I came back to Israel,
and
before I went?
Signed Eitan as the head of it.
Yes, for the agency. It was the, so to speak, and he said, "The pension is very good." I said, "I'm very sorry, no good to me. I cannot do it. I'm not the man. I know I can't."
Just by this other
3 minutes.
And you even then you were not close to Sharet. I mean, you were not in...
I was never close to Sharet.
You never said close.
Close never. I met him. I met Sharet. Wait a minute, when did I meet Sharet? I certainly met him in Washington towards the end of the war. But I must have met him before that. I met Sharet in 45. The British Embassy came to see me. But I think I must have met him before. I wonder when. No, I can't have done. Because I was in Israel in 34. I was not there again until 47. met him in London or New York?
Maybe, yes, but that makes no difference. I mean, it's not kind of relations that just by telephone one offers a job, you know.
He was just talk when I met him.
Yes.
So I think still. He came to see me in Washington in 45 and tried to get me to tell him all kinds of things. And he tried to fish, I couldn't tell him very much. But I had a long and amicable conversation with him, told him all I could.
Yeah. But coming back to a kibbutz, you still have maintained this positive
attitude. Throughout. Yeah. I never lost it. And it was a wonderful thing. I thought it really was that kind of idealism which comes from the Russian Socialist Revolutionary Party plus Tolstoy, which is where it comes from, who is exactly like corresponding Russians of that period, who are also moving characters. No, I thought it had a certain purity and a certain devotion to a kind of honorable life, which only East Europeans had. It was impossible in the West. In that sense, you could say that the East was more pure than the West. It couldn't occur in Western Europe. And it was deeply Russian, the whole thing. That's why it appealed to me. Polish Russian, but especially Russian. Old-fashioned, 19th century.
And you believed from the very beginning that it has a future, that it can exist, that
yes, certainly. I didn't know what the economic facts were.
Yeah, no, I mean from sociological point of view, from human nature point of view.
Oh, yes. All the people I met then and afterwards were seemed to me entirely without, didn't look to me as if it would disintegrate. I didn't feel as there were quarrels there or there was jealousies or no doubt there were. But you see, I didn't feel, when I used to lunch with them, I used to go to meals and keep with them with those long tables, I used to feel entirely entirely at home.
And the Severin Genosar?
Ah, that I told you about before. Severin Genosar, I thought was terribly bogus, terribly phony. Simply the Seder and Seder, but the things, first of all, the deliberate production of bread to show that, oh yes, slices of bread to show where we were, quite a matzah and bread, it's anti-clerical in a very violent degree. Yes, yes, certainly, 50s, after World War II marriage, after 56. Was the late 50s. Then you see, the things they said I had to recite, I had to recite a few psalms, but mainly they read things from Emerson, Bialik, you can imagine, I don't know what, probably Charles Stuart Mill, God knows what. All these secular texts, as opposed to the horrible. Exactly. Anti-clerical, secular texts, deliberate, flouting.
Putting action on the natural aspect of the feast and not the religion.
Exactly. The feast of liberation, Yitzhak Mitzrayim, that was all right. And spring. Yitzhak Mitzrayim meant something. They believed it might have happened historically. But mainly not. Spring in general, the spring festival, songs, children. Who did I meet there? I remember some London girl who was a daughter of mine called Epstein. Yes. She was there. She's still there and alive.
She's a theologist and she discovered in the Golan Heights quite interesting things.
Crazy. Her father was called Mortimer Epstein. He would have had to be something you call Mortimer for a Jew.
He had quite a good library. I mean, she studied in London when I was here in the 50s, and I went to see her. He had a very good library in Dubai.
Oh, no, he learned Jew. No, he was. He was very much a Jewish scholar. He edited yearbooks, I think. The Statesman yearbook, which was very statistical stuff. Mortimer. And she's a nice girl, very idealistic, and yeah. I'm rather moved by the fact that she actually went from London, which she had a perfectly nice life here, and joined the kibbutz and stayed there. The man I never saw in Israel, and I blame myself for that to this day, is my old Hebrew teacher from Petrograd.
The teacher discovered the name.
Vansky.
Yes,
Esser. He became Esser.
He had eyes before Esser.
What happened?
Ben-Zion Esser.
He was Ben-Zion Vansky. When did he die?
I don't know. I
never looked him up. I never knew where he was.
He was active in the Kerem Kayemet. There was a committee that gave Hebrew names to...
So he did that?
He was very active.
No. What names?
And he produced a geographical map of
the kind of thing. I remember very well what he looked like. He was a student in the 20s in 1916-17. I was very fond of him. I was devoted to him. And he was the man who used to make me write little Hebrew verses called, what is it called? Chadashot L'Pekarim.
That he didn't try to get in touch with you when he visited
me. I don't think he knew.
But I don't know.
I don't think he knew that I was there.
I'll find out.
I had no idea that I was there. I mean, 34, I wasn't known to anybody.
Not in 34,
but... Well, he might not have. I don't know how old he was. Then there was Michael Pizarevsky, who I liked rather less, who taught Hebrew in London. He called himself... not Sifri, Sofer, something to do with, besides an artist to write. So, his son is home. Safran, something I don't know. Not Sofer. He was another crude type from Kiev. These are my Hebrew teachers. Well, I'll tell you who taught me Hebrew. Also, that was that rather nice man whose daughters married so well. Schwartz. Zvi Schwartz. In London, yes. For about 6 months. He was the LSE. All these tried to make money. There was Michael Levitsky. There was a lawyer called Levitsky. He taught me for a bit. Schwartz taught me for a bit. I didn't learn too much. Well, yes, you see. But I like Schwartz. I saw him. Is he alive? No. In 90?
Yes.
Came to London not so long ago.
He's still alive. His wife is still alive.
Wonderful. His daughter's married.
One daughter married Diane, and one daughter was married to Ezra Weissman.
Ezra Weissman, that's right. So I remember. Perfectly nice man. Yes. Sort of respectable lawyer.
Yes.
What was his party? Mapai.
Yeah, Mapai, the mainstream of Mapai.
Surely. He looked like that.
In the same group, David Akroyan was in London.
Whom I met in Israel. David Akroyan. Whom I never knew, really. And not for about half an hour, I think I knew him too.
But, I mean, coming back to the question whether really to settle in Israel. Did you ever consider it seriously?
Oh, yes.
Or it was easy for you to decide that?
No, I decided immediately.
Hmm?
I decided at once. After 47. I realized why I didn't take the job, which I read on the quite about Meitan. I realized that if I went, there's nothing I could do. First of all, I would have to learn Hebrew, about which I was too old. It would be rather painful. Difficult, painful. I would have made terrible efforts. Secondly, I didn't particularly want to teach at the university, where I thought the standard was not too high, and there would be nobody for me to talk to about my subject. Thirdly, I thought if I did anything political in Israel. I would be torn to pieces in the first 3 hours. I realized I couldn't survive. My temperament and character, it was too violent. I mean, I was too thin-skinned. I couldn't take it. I love being there, as you know. Even now, less now than before, for obvious reasons. But in general, so to speak, when I used to go to Israel in the 50s and 60s, and even early 70s, I used to feel it's my country. As soon as I emerged into a street, I felt totally at home with everything. Whether they spoke, whatever language they spoke, wherever they came from, whether it was Faradim, Ashkenazim, black, white, I mean, whatever they sold, whatever it was, I was completely familiar. I felt no kind of barrier.
You know, you told it to Raymond Carr, apparently, either in your interview or after the interview, when he interviewed you.
Could be.
And he was so impressed by it.
Quite good.
He said it to me the other day. We went to see him in Devon.
Could well be, you did. But I felt comfortable in Israel.
Yes, that you felt that was your home. So
comfortable, totally comfortable.
But how come that you never came, let's say, as a visiting professor for half a year or a year? And you were very invited.
No, I don't think I was. I didn't think I was much. Later, when I couldn't anymore. You see, when I was a professor here, I could never get away for as long as it. When I used to go to from All Souls, I was never invited. I have delivered lectures as well.
Oh, yes.
Not often. Not often.
I remember all of them.
Yes, I did. Papers and very... But I think I may have been invited. I don't think philosophy department ever invited me. I don't think I ever did. Whether I could have done it or not, I don't know, but I was never invited.
It's
yes, but I think they're rather thin-skinned about that. Didn't them? You see, by the time people like Stuart and Freddie Eyre were invited, I was already two ensconced, I was no good.
Yeah.
I was no longer doing philosophy anyway. I stopped doing proper philosophy in about 1950-something. Well, anyhow, it never really happened. Didn't think so. If it did, I could. But when it didn't go, but I couldn't. No, the Rotenstreich never invited me.
But others, I mean, even the historical department. I mean, it's very odd.
I don't think I noticed.
Fantastic.
I don't think I noticed. I was never part of the academic life of Israel. I really wasn't. See what I mean? You know, each other people, let's say someone like Neuberger, made himself very familiar with all these, but I never was. You know. I was never put on any particular committee, I was never put on any academic committee of the university, nothing of that sort. You see? I don't think so.
Before we finish, let's come back to one question from the previous meeting. I think we have 10 minutes. Still is Israel. Were you impressed by any of the Israeli military men?
Yeah, other than Yitzhak Sadeh.
Gori Galalon.
Yes, certainly. I was impressed by certain qualities in them. First of all, I was impressed by the man who came to St. Anthony's.
Chaim
Laskov. I thought he was very honest, upright, solid, dependable, excellent man to be employed in any capacity. Not brilliant, not terribly intelligent, not very enterprising, but it's kind of bricks which one could build a building. A good citizen. And entrusted a task, would carry it out. Totally uncorrupt. Completely solid. I liked him though. He was not at all interesting, That's not what I asked for. Morally okay. That's number one. I found Diane not that interesting. I realized that he was not exactly straight. I realized he was a complicated, somewhat devious figure, but I could see that he had a certain charisma. And I could see that he was a quick-moving mind, and that he was rather brilliant, that he had particular gifts beyond the normal that I saw. I knew that Weizmann liked him particularly, because he liked Nahalal in general. Liked his father, liked him. But I realized that he was not exactly a man of unimpeachable integrity that I knew. But still, I can't say I wasn't impressed. Whenever I talked to him, not very often, I always went away with something. He always said something intelligent, interesting, important. What other journals do I ever know?
Are you generally interested in journals? I mean, by a limited...
No. Nor did I ever know it. Very many. What journals have I ever known? British journals. I never knew any during the war. I wasn't here. I met a few, but I mean... No, I didn't think. General Swinton I knew. Fair of all souls. Man who invented the tank. And got out quite well with him. American journal? No.
Now let's come back for a second to your publications, articles, and so on. When we discussed the importance or relative importance of your articles in two conversations, we didn't refer to the lecture on the Israeli and Marx and Moshe Hess.
On the, which one? Which was the first?
Marx and the Israeli.
Oh, yes.
And the other one was the
yeah,
first.
Yeah.
Now, to begin with, I mean, what's your attitude of those two articles? And secondly, did you have any special reaction toward them because they deal with problems of Jewish identity?
Entirely. But there's no, I mean, my essays are about nothing else.
Yes.
That's, and Moses Hess is not an article about Moses Hess's Spinozist or Hegelian ideas. I mean, of course, of no interest to me as a young Marxist, as a left-wing Marxist, so-called true Marxism, I think, Avada Marxism, he was of no great interest to me. No. The essay on Hess was entirely because of Roman Jerusalem. And because he was the first person really to nail down the thesis about what is wrong with assimilation. I don't think anybody else stated it. He was the first and displeased a lot of German Jews.
Who drew your attention to him? I mean, you didn't think...
Nobody. No. I just knew who he was. I came across him because of Karl Marx, with him because he's rather involved in Marxist, the history of Marxism. And finally, I decided to read Roman Jerusalem quite spontaneously. Famous book. Why shouldn't I read it? I was deeply impressed, moved by it. I realized he was an entirely decent, honest man. Not very clever, but honorable. Man of great integrity. And the exact opposite of Isaac Deutscher, I decided, as a character. He was very pure-hearted and honorable, and Isaac Deutscher was a twister. I met him about that time. The second is also Marx and Israeli. He's entirely about Zionism.
Sure.
What else is it about?
Anyway, Jewish identity. Jewish. Now, except Herder, that consciously or unconsciously,
quite.
Zionism, but people cannot.
Herder was Zionist. Herder was Zionist.
Yes.
In a rather anti-Semitic way.
Yes, but I can see another reader who can read Herder per se and don't realize that Isaiah Berlin came to it via his and his attitude toward Zionism and nationalism.
Mm, quite.
The Israeli Marx and Moses Hess are clear
for Jewish identity. Certainly.
Now, keep friends of you, discuss it with you orally, or these people write about it.
Never.
Because you think
never. Never. Never.
And maybe it's your
never.
Problem,
never. Never.
Never.
Never. Nobody praised it. Nobody blamed it. I never got criticism of it. I never got discussions of it. I never got people. Just some people said they were impressed, or on the contrary, thought I went too far, I was wrong. Nothing. Produced no reactions of any kind. The only reaction which Marx and the Israeli cause, people were talking, some people read it, said they read it with interest.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they read the other thing with interest. Nothing. No Jews, no Israelis. Nobody ever...
And among your friends?
No. The lecture on his, I delivered in Rehovot before I published it. No reaction. Well, it was
right.
Somebody asked the questions.
That's a natural
question. Question. Questions were asked. You see?
Now, would you add now your lecture on Albert Einstein to this category?
Certainly.
Why did you pick up? Why did you decide to?
Because I wanted.
You wanted or you were asked?
No. I was certainly invited to the centenary, apropos of nothing. And would I like to write about Einstein? Well, just because I was by this time fairly prominent. I thought, I knew that Einstein's, the people who surrounded Einstein in America were violently anti-Zionist, left-wing assimilationist Jews. And I thought, I would write something to irritate these people. It was entirely naughtiness. And when I began reading, what I knew that Einstein was a Zionist. That's what everybody knew, of some kind. And when I began reading what he actually said, this was surprising to me.
Oh.
I didn't realize how Jewish he was and how Zionist he was. And that delighted me, because by the time I met him,
I was going to ask you whether you discovered it through working on it.
Oh, no. I discovered it because I was determined originally, you see, to annoy the people, and I did annoy them. They were all Jews, secretaries and various German Jews. The last thing they wanted was Einstein and Zionism. They couldn't help coming to Jerusalem because all the papers were left to the university. So they came. Anyhow, Einstein said, what could they do? But when I delivered that lecture, it was very well received by the audience and deeply irritating to the 5-6 old German-Jewish intimates of Einstein.
But you knew, when you started writing, I mean, you knew that you will be able to present this Jewish agenda.
Well, I decided to find out.
Only through which you discovered more than you expected. Right,
certainly. I had no idea. How could one know all these things she said? I began looking at a little paper bag, which contained all kinds of observations of a non-mathematical kind. And there I found all these scattered Jewish references. But I mean, originally, I suddenly thought, well, if I have to talk about that, we'll see what there is. I didn't accept invitation until I made sure there was enough to say. Then I wrote it with great satisfaction. I don't think Einstein would have liked it all that much, because I pushed him a little further. He probably was prepared to go, but I did that quite deliberately. I knew what I was doing. I mean, I was stimulated by malice.
I was wondering while reading it, how far did you know in advance, how far did you find while preparing it, and how far did you push it a little further? Yeah, I see now. Yes.
I don't think I ever knew that he made a statement to the German Jews in 1931 or whatever it was. You know, the famous statement saying our ancestors were poor specimens physically, probably intellectually maybe, so, but morally, that's superior to us. That delighted me. That's a Chabad statement, almost.
Yeah,
After all, when I met Einstein, he was a complete failure. My visit.
When was it?
1946.
Yes. You went to him from?
Felix Frankfurter said, would you like to meet Einstein? As a tourist, I went to Princeton. I called on his office. Frankfurter wrote me a letter. I wrote a letter to him. I was coming. He greeted me. No idea where I was. And said, you, well, where you be, what do you do? I said, I'm working at the British Embassy. I'm just back from Russia. What is it like in the Soviet Union? I gave a description of Stalin's Moscow and Leningrad, which is what I knew, and I could see it was a little painful for him to hear this. He was never a communist, never pro-Soviet, but by this time he was violently anti-American because of the atom bomb, and I suppose Pentagon and people around him. He was by this time signed fellow traveling pro-communist declarations. So then he said, you know, would you say that the government in Russia has the confidence of the people? I said, that is not a question which can be asked about that country. There's no evidence of confidence or the lack of it. That is not how it's governed. The country is not very, government is not very interested in confidence. There's not, oh, he said, that is not good. It is not good when the government does not have the confidence of the citizens. It's simple, naive statements. Then he said to me, do you think that things will become better now after the war? And I said, no, I don't think there's any evidence of it. So with Stalin is there, this is very tight. I said, no way we shall be relaxed. And I went on right like this. I could see he was gradually becoming more and more gloomy. And he began looking at me as if I was a colonel from the Pentagon, obviously a right-wing anti-Soviet propagandist. So I said to him, after a bit, first Einstein, I'm sure you have work to do. I'm sure I oughtn't to take your time. I think I'd better go. He said, yes. After which I left. I felt that he then wrote a letter to Felix Frankfurter, which he forwarded to me, saying this curious cosmopolitan figure who appears to have visited many countries, I could not discover what his from basic point of view was. Something like that. Puzzled by me. He didn't take to me. I respect, I admired him, but I could see. The point is that he was childish, not just childlike. Childish, naive, and in some ways simply a silly old sheep. He combined this with sharpness of intellect, with great nobility of character, and with tremendous gullibility.
Now, did he change your attitude toward him, let's say...
In no way. In no way. Because he wasn't a hero before.
He was not?
No.
I was going to ask.
No. I admired him because the whole world admired him. But I mean, as a great scientist and a noble Jew and Victor Hitler, I mean, in a way everybody thought about him, but nothing special. But I wrote my piece about him, as you can see, without the slightest. The visit did not influence me. I didn't hint in any way that there was something weak in him or something silly. No, no. I was completely, I was, in that respect, in no way influenced by my personal impression of him as a man. He was never a hero.
Among this, I think...
You have to go and dress.
I think so.
For dinner, I'm afraid. Yes.
If you could, if you may, you could add to your list of heroes somebody from the sciences.
I don't know enough about science. I don't know enough about science to be able to judge who really I know that people regard Einstein as a genius, but why I cannot tell you. I do not understand either the special or the general theory of relativity. I cannot tell you why it altered our views of time and space. I know what people say. But the people who say it don't understand it themselves.
By the way, let's take the opportunity. I want to put in some observation. I don't know whether you saw some of the obituaries on Salvador Dali.
Yes, sir.
There is something very amazing here. After all, obituaries about people like Dali are prepared in advance.
Yes.
And they have
yes.
And yet, so many of the obituaries are confused. And you see the people can't really decide what to say.
I think in England they were not prepared in advance. Very non-Dali conscious.
I can never
in Spain, France, Italy, America would have much more prepared obituaries. But anyway, they're confused because they couldn't make out what he was. Not because they weren't prepared.
Right.
Was he a charlatan? Was he a great painter?
What do we make of him? Lately, during the last 20 years?
Nothing like that.
It's a phenomenal insight.
Well, he was all these things. He was he was mad. He was a charlatan. He was dishonest. He was rather nasty. He was brilliantly talented. He was obviously a personality of the first order.
All right.
So what do we say?
And nobody decided what to, I know that he was all of that, and yet people can prepare something more, to decide.
More coherent.
More coherent. Either to stress on.
No, they couldn't make a problem. It's left problematic.
I
think you would find that obituaries of Cagliostro would be of the same kind.
All right.
Magicians and charlatans of a certain kind.
In my experience, that's the first time that I
understand.